So when we're reading the Buddhist scriptures, it soon becomes obvious that we're not dealing with isolated or independent texts, but rather we're dealing with a very complex system of many thousands of texts, many thousands of passages, which stem from what is on the whole a very unified and consistent point of view. That's not to say that there might not be inconsistencies, but on the whole, given the breadth of the Buddhist scriptures, and here I'm referring mainly to the early Pali canon, then it's actually a remarkable degree of consistency in the scriptures. Now, that doesn't arise by chance. It arises because of an editorial process and a construction process which has led to the actual canon as we have it today. That process is ongoing. Even as we speak, there are efforts to improve the Pali canon, to improve the editing of it, to make it available in online forms and digital forms that haven't been previously available. And these changes, constant changes, will change the way that people relate to a text in very meaningful ways. Texts are not things that do not exist in themselves. As one of my bugbears in literary criticism is people who argue that you should read the text as it is. The texts as they are really don't exist. We have a library downstairs full of books. What do the words on those pages say? Well, the words on those pages say precisely nothing. They're black because the books are closed and they're in the shelves. So there's in fact no meaningful content on any of the books physically right now as we speak. They only have a meaningful contact when they're taken off, meaningful content when they're taken off those shelves, when we open them, when light falls on the page. That light's reflected into our eyes and forms patterns within our eyes. Those patterns engage with the patterns that we've learnt in our brain through memory, through training, through previous experience, and all of that generates this highly ambiguous and indefinable thing that we call meaning as a response to the text. So the idea of a Pali canon as a kind of fixed and unified thing is really just a kind of a myth. There's a sense in which we can say, for example, a book, even though I've just said that a book, the text in a book doesn't really exist until we look at it, but there's another sense in which we can say, well, of course it exists. It's sitting there and it exists all at once, and we can say that sutra exists. There it is. But for example, if we're thinking of an oral literature, then it exists in a far more tenuous sense. In an oral literature, the text only exists as each phoneme is uttered by the speaker. So as I'm speaking now, this class, there's only one, I'm only making one sound at a time, and it's only that which actually exists as from what I'm actually saying. And the meaning of what I'm saying, if it has a meaning, which is something for you to decide, I'm merely making suggestions, if it has a meaning, the meaning is something that you can construct in your own mind. And so that meaning is quite different for each person who's sitting here and who's listening to this. So the nature of an oral text is quite different from the nature of a written text. And that's only one way in which they're different. They're different in many, many other ways as well. The nature of a written text is different if it's, say, in a palm leaf manuscript than if it's in a book. In book, we engage with books in different ways. We engage with something in a digital format in a different way. Even though we might say the words are the same, it still says Eva Me Sutan. And whether it's an oral text or a written text on a palm leaf manuscript or one in a book or one on a digital computer, it all says Eva Me Sutan. But the way that we actually engage with it will differ quite radically. When we're reading things on a screen, for example, we tend to hunt and peck. We don't read things slowly and reflectively because we have too much choice. We're always moving on to the next thing. So the computer screen is a very good medium for checking out details and for looking for different references and comparing things. For that kind of work, it's very good. But for reflective and contemplative reading, it's extremely poor. And so for that sense, a book is a much better way of being able to kind of slowly take in a text and to be able to assimilate it. And of course, knowing something orally is different again. And the way that we relate to a text orally, we may be when we have an oral literature, we tend to go. So when we have an oral text memorized, we tend to go right from the beginning through to the end. It's much more holistic. We don't skip pages and so on. So the manner in which the text is passed down has a major impact on the meaning of the text and how it functions and operates within a community. The technology that's used has a major impact. And these days we have, anybody can access the Pali Canon and the Chinese Canon and so on, and we can get these things very cheaply, very easily, very quickly. And so this differs greatly from the situation in the past where very often, if we consider monastics in the past, it's very often would be the case that they simply had never stayed in a monastery or in a place where they actually had copies, physical copies, of the suttas. And this would probably be the case for the majority of Theravadan monastics before the last century, that apart from the few rich and prestigious monasteries, most places would not have actually had copies of the suttas, and the monks would never have read them in their life, and their teachers would never have read them either. This is still the case in Thailand. So again, our task, our way of relating to these things is always shifting and always shaped by these different considerations and criteria. Now, when we're thinking of the early Buddhist texts, I've said that the Pali Canon and the Buddhist scriptures are in a sense a living tradition. They're still evolving today, and that's very true, but it's also true to say that there's a very strong degree of continuity. Any editorial changes or other changes that have been made in the last quite a long while are probably fairly minor, and for probably over 2,000 years the basic canonical texts have remained fairly fixed, fairly with very little change, and that has been the main purpose of the redactors and the editors. They've wanted to preserve it down without changing, as opposed to somebody, for example, who comes from a creative perspective or an artistic perspective, who wants to introduce changes and so on to display their own personality and their own imagination. With the Pali texts, the overwhelming majority emphasis is to want to preserve it exactly and perfectly. And that's been done, generally speaking, fairly successfully. Remarkably successfully, actually. So the choices which dictate the exact form and the shape, the position and so on of the text as we have it today were mainly those forces that were operating in the Sangha in the first couple of centuries during the Buddha's life and following the Buddha's death. And that's the period in which we typically would locate the main process of redaction and formation of the texts. Now, in one of the later classes, we'll have a look at some of the very many different versions of the Samanyapada Sutta, and there's been some very interesting and quite detailed studies of the similarities and differences between the different versions of this particular text. But what I'd like to look at today or consider in a bit more detail is to start with a general overview and some considerations on where does this sutta fit in with the Buddhist scriptures as a whole. Now, I mentioned when I was starting out that when we read the suttas, we can detect patterns. We hear echoes, we hear resonances, we recognize that there's something said in one place that is the same as something that's said in another place. There's something said in a third place which is a little bit different. And there's something said in a fourth place which actually explains the meaning of what was said in all of those three places. So we don't approach each text as being individual and self-sufficient, but we approach it as part of a matrix or a pattern of text and meaning, which has been formed and created and crystallized in very complex ways. So while it's obvious to see that there are these patterns, that there are these repetitions, these echoes, these similarities, it's not at all obvious what that actually means or how to deal with that, where it comes from, how to explain it, how to understand it. And so it was when I was doing my detailed study into Satipatthana and looking at Satipatthana not only in the Satipatthana Sutta in the Pali, but also in the Chinese versions of it, the different Abhidhamma versions of it, the Prajnaparamita version of it, and the Jaina context, the pre-Buddhist context in the Vedas, and so on and so forth, as well as all the many different suttas and contexts within the early Nikayas or Agamas that talk about Satipatthana. That was a very complex process of study that I did for quite a few years to try to sort through all the material. And while I was doing that, it gradually occurred to me and gradually became apparent that there was a sense of I could begin to feel a sense of order and system that was underlying the way that the Buddhist texts are arranged and the way that they relate to each other. And this system is very partial. It's not perfect. It's somewhat obscure and somewhat difficult to recognize. But I do believe that it's there and that it's played an important role quite consciously in the development of the Buddhist scriptures that we have today. Now, that system and that shape of the Buddhist scriptures is what I called in the first part of the history of mindfulness, I called the gist, is the general integrated sutta theory, which I thought it was sort of modeled after the physics idea as a kind of the unified theory and so on. It was a grand unified theory, the gut. Or the theory of everything, the toe. And so on. So anyway, so I thought of the gist. So what the gist does is the gist makes or describes a pattern by which I postulate that the ancient Buddhist scriptures were formed, and it shows how the existing scriptures, which are descended from those earlier scriptures, still reflect that pattern in various kinds of ways. And I still think it provides a pretty good explanation for quite a lot of important things about how the scriptures are as they are today. So a bit of an overview of that in this afternoon's class. Now the basic idea is that, so as we go on, by the way, if anyone has any questions or anything, then please feel free at any time. When we look at how the scriptures are organized, the suttas themselves, When we receive the scriptures today, we have them in terms of course, the well-known pattern of the four Nikayas or the five Nikayas in Pali, the Vinaya Pitaka and the Abhidhamma Pitaka. And here we've got quite a convenient little graphical representation of that. This is from the World Tipitaka site, and it gives outlines quite nicely the Pali Canon as accepted today in the Theravadan countries. And on the left, of course, the Vinaya, the Parajika and the Pachitya, which is the Parimokkha and the Vibhanga, the Mahabhaga and the Chulabhaga, which is the Kandikas and the Parivara, which is the later addendum. Skipping over the suttas for now, then the Abhidhamma and the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 books of the Abhidhamma. Curiously enough, they've put the Yamaka and Patana separately because these are so big. These are basically just massive series of repetitions. That's the 7 books of the Abhidhamma over there. And in between the 5 Nikayas of the Sutta Pitaka, or Suttanta Pitaka. And the Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanyutta Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, and down there the Khuddaka Nikaya. Of those Nikayas, the first 4 are the most important. The Khuddaka Nikaya, Khudda means lesser or minor Nikaya, and it was more or less a miscellaneous category where all kinds of things got placed, although the important parts of the early texts in the Khuddaka Nikaya are some of the verses which are found. So Digha, Majjhima, Sanyutta and Anguttara. Now, in the suttas themselves, they don't refer to that system of the Tipitaka, so the word Tipitaka doesn't occur in the suttas themselves, nor does the word Nikaya in the sense that it has here. Nor do we find the distinction and classification of things as Digha, Majjhima, Sanyutta, and so on. So what that tells us is that that system of organizing these scriptures wasn't current during the lifetime of the Buddha. It was something which was developed and systematized after the time of the Buddha himself. Nevertheless, there was a system of organizing the scriptures which is referred to in the early suttas, and that's referred to not only in the Pali canon but also in the canons of various other schools, so it's quite widely found. Just trying to find the list of them. Oh, here we go. Yeah, here's the list of angas. Excellent. Okay, so here's the list of angas. Thank you, Wikipedia. Now, this particular list is found commonly in the actual suttas themselves, alright? And so that at least suggests that it's possible that classification system existed in the time of the Buddha himself. Okay, so here we have the one sutra, Geya, Vyakarana, Gata, Udana, Iti, Ityukta, in the Sanskrit form, maybe more familiar with the Pali form, Iti Vuttaka, Jataka, Buddha Dharma, and this is the Buddha Dharma. This is Vaipulya. Oh, where, this is right. This is, should be Vaipulya is not Vaipulya. It should be oh God, I forgot now. Vedala. More likely, but anyway, that's the Sanskrit form that's usually used by Buddha, Vedala. So these ones are found in more or less all the schools, so the first 9, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and then the last 3 are found in the some of the Sanskrit lists alone, so they're probably a later addition. And here gives a simple and more or less conventional explanation of them. The sutra prose discourses, especially short declarative discourses. Oh, that's interesting. I'm thinking that these, I'll go through them. Gaya, mixed prose and verse discourse identified with the Sagata Vagga of the Sanyutta Nikaya. the Vyakarana explanation or analysis discourses in question and answer format. Gatha is verses, Udana inspired speech, ityukta, beginning with "Thus has the Bhagavan said." That's what the Pali Itivuttaka begins with. Jataka, story of previous life of the Buddha, a Buddha Dhamma concerning wonders and miraculous events. Vaipulya, either extended discourses or those giving joy. Probably both of those explanations are incorrect. Nidana, in which the teachings are set within their circumstances of origin. So the Nidana being the origin story itself, actually. Avadana, sales of exploits, usually the past lives of disciples of the Buddha. And Upadesha, defined and considered instructions, quite close to the perhaps Abhidhamma text.
Now, Avadana,
it's the same as Apadana, yeah. Avadana in Sanskrit and Apadana in Pali, yeah. Most of these are fairly similar to the Pali forms, except for Iti. Exactly, yeah. So, not entirely sure what this is referring to as such, whether it means those origin stories. Nidana is also used to mean the life story of the Buddha. So anything like that is a Nidana. Actually, these days in Thailand, Nidana means legend. So if you say something's a Nitan, it has the same meaning as it does if you say in English, oh, that's just a myth. Yeah, that's what Nidana is. And when I looked at that, I thought the first three, and I thought they looked surprisingly accurate, and I wonder whether that's because whoever wrote this was influenced by my own explanations of it. But anyway, I would disagree with a couple of these later ones. Gatha is pretty good, verse, and particularly things like the Teragatha, Terigatha, and so on. The Udana is things like, of course, the book Udana in the Pali, but also the Dhammapada. And the Dhammapada and Udana literature are actually very close. There might be things which are considered Dhammapadas in Chinese, which are much closer to what we have as the Udana, and so on. So
all of these can occur throughout any of the books?
That's another question. They are mixed up within the Nikayas. But that's one of the controversies about this, do these refer to actual scriptural collections, or are they merely styles of text, sort of types of literary style? So this is, I'll talk a bit more about that later on. Iti yukta, not entirely sure what that means, but I suspect what the iti yukta is the cosmological myths originally. Similar, but anyway, that's not so important for us. The Jataka and Buddha Dhamma, where, for example, you have stories of the Buddha's birth and the lists of the wonderful and marvelous, miraculous events that happened when the Buddha was born. This one, Vaipulya, is probably the Pali form is Vedala, and Vedala itself is controversial in its meaning, but what I think it means is from the word root to split or to break up, and the actual meaning of it should be analysis. And the suttas in the Pali, which are actually called Vedala, are actually very analytical discourses. So this, given, but later on became used as Vaipulya, meaning extended, great long discourses, and so this is where the Mahayana included their texts within this particular system. Sorry? The Vedala?
Yeah,
maybe so, yeah. Like a compilation of different questions and answers on different things, yeah?
Someone put question and the other answer. And the question and the
miscellaneous, yeah. Miscellaneous, yeah. So that would also be similar to that root. If the root is from dal, which is to break up, then there could be like lots of broken, like individual things in there. It could be the same meaning. Anyway, I think the most important ones of these are the first three. And there are a few passages, and this is a little bit controversial, but I won't go into the detail. If you want to hear the counter-argument, I can show you Venerable Analio's counter-argument, which I don't entirely agree with. But there is a few passages that seem to suggest that the Sutta Gaya and Vyakarana were in fact earlier than all the rest of them. All right? Now, one thing which supports that argument, if we look at this and we compare those angas with the Kuddhika Nikaya, okay, so we have the Gatha, okay, which we find in the Teragata, Terigata, but also things like Suttanipata and Kuddhikapata and so on are also Gatha texts, Udana, of course, being also found in the Kuddhika. The Iti Wuttaka, also a Kuddhika Nikaya text. The Jataka, also found in the Kuddhika. And Abhuta Dhamma is not found as a classification. These other ones are not found as particular classifications there. But most of these later angas, are similar to or seem to have quite a close correlation with texts which are found today in the Kuddhika Nikaya. And so that would support the suggestion that the original, earlier form of this was the threefold Sutta Gaya and Vyakarana, and that the extra angas came later. Now that doesn't necessarily mean that everything in those angas is a later text, because there are certain ones of the Gathas, for example, which are regarded as very early, and there's no controversy about that. But what we're talking about here is when these things became accepted and categorized and included in a canonical form. So that's quite a different thing from saying how old the text is itself. We're talking about how old it's actually collected in these particular collections. Now, so I'm going to mainly ignore these later ones and focus on these three, Sutta Gaya and Vyakarana. Just to briefly look at what the basic meaning of the words is. Sutra,
just to confirm what you said earlier, I think you said that all of these styles or categories or whatever are what is actually included in the suttas themselves, in the texts themselves. Things like Nikaya, word wasn't there.
That's right. The actual list of the angas is found in the suttas themselves. That's right, exactly. And the first nine are found in the Pali texts. And the 12 are found in most of the Sanskrit texts, although there's some of the Chinese and other texts also have 9 as well, but most of the other have 12.
Are they included as a list?
As a list.
And
definition? No, there's no definitions given in the suttas. It just says, you know, somebody here memorizes the teachings, the Sutta Gaya, Vyakarana, and so on. Yeah, so it's given us the list of teachings. It's a bit similar to when it lists the like a Brahmin who's learned it in the three Vedas or something like that, and lists the things. And actually, I think there's probably some connections between this and the Vedic systematology as well. Okay, so sutra. The basic meaning of sutra is thread, which is a very interesting metaphor to use for, you know, we have that same metaphor in English all the time. We talk about spinning a yarn. You know, we talk about all kinds of metaphors regarding cloth and spinning and weaving and so on. Sorry? Tying up the loose threads of an argument and all kinds of metaphors, yeah? And it's interesting that one suggestion has been that the one reason for that close metaphorical connection is because storytelling was very often used as an art which accompanied weaving and sewing, because they're essentially very boring things which you sit there all day and do, and especially it would be women's activity, so they sit round in a little circle weaving and so on and sewing or knitting and everything, and telling stories as they do so. And so that kind of, it's a very nice origin for that kind of metaphor. So we're used to using, now one of the things when we're looking at things from a historical perspective, and we always have to try to kind of leap back over the top of the text, of the time period that we're looking at, and so we sort of leap over the top and try to sort of splash down in the river of time somewhat before the period that we're looking at, so we can see things from the same angle that we looked at before. Does that make sense? You know, they're coming at it from downstream, Sorry, they're coming at it from upstream. They're in the mountains and they're coming down and they see this thing from that direction. We're already further down near the ocean. And so if we approach it from our perspective, we'll see a different side of things. Yeah? So this is, we can never really do that 100%, but we try to leap over the top of it and come down to it from as if we were beforehand. Now, sutra, in its basic or etymological, usage is of a thread, but in its basic or most common usage, what it meant was it referred to a short statement or aphorism. And it's often actually translated as aphorism, like the Yoga Sutras are translated like aphorisms of yoga. So it's a short little, somewhat cryptic statement which would be memorized and which typically would be used as the basis for an oral discourse. So the part of something which would be memorized would be the actual sutta, and then an explanation would be given. Now, it's in this sense, I think, that, for example, the Patimokkha is called a sutra. So we're used to distinguishing between the Vinaya on one hand and the suttas on the other hand. But the Patimokkha calls itself a sutta. Okay, so in the Patimokkha itself, it refers to itself and it calls itself sutta. And so what that means, I think, is this idea that Patimokkha was like a list or a set of aphorisms, basic rules, which then would be explained in the Vinaya classes and teachings, which of course is all the background stories and analysis and so on, which we have together with that. That's how these texts were meant to be used in the Indian context. Okay, so I think that's what sutta actually originally meant. It had a much narrower set of meanings than we take it today. So sutta doesn't mean everything that's in the Sutta Pitaka. It only means certain of the discourses there. Now, Gaya itself literally means song. And it's obviously here a form for a literary style. And it's been identified with the Saggata Wagga of the Samyutta Nikaya. Now, that identification happens both in the Pali tradition, in the commentaries of Buddhaghosa, and also in the northern tradition, for example, in Asanga's Yogacara Bhumi Shastra. So, and I should add here, by the way, that explanations of these angas are given in the traditional commentaries by Buddhaghosa and Asanga, and no doubt elsewhere as well. And those explanations would differ to some degree from the explanation I'm giving now. So if you're interested to research it more carefully, then you can have a look at some of those traditional explanations of them as well. Obviously, I think there are problems with the traditional explanation, and that's why I sort of launched on this historical inquiry. So, but we do find that there's this conformity that both the southern and the northern traditions identify Gaya with the Saggata Wagga of the Samyutta Nikaya. And that's an interesting identification. There's no, Gaya, we would expect it to have a verse component, but there's no particular reason from the name of it why it should be associated with the Saggata Wagga as such. But nevertheless, we'll leave that aside just for now. And the third one of these things is Vyakarana. Now, the literal meaning of Vyakarana is an answer. And that's how it's used in about 95% of the context in the Pali canon. I'm going to ask you this question, what answer are you going to give me? Okay? Now, it also has a number of other meanings, but those other meanings are mostly in later texts, okay? So this is why sometimes you find different explanations of what Vyakarana means. It also is used in later texts to mean a prophecy. It's also used to mean a grammar. And so on. So it does have some other meanings, which you might find occasionally in the early texts, but by far the most common usage is it means an answer. And it usually suggests like an answer which is a bit of an explanatory answer, not just a yes-no answer, but an analytical answer that explains the topic. So one of the things that struck me when I was looking at these and then considering what the meanings of them were was, it says here, the discourses in question in Q&A format. And it struck me how very, very common that format was. And in fact, that almost all the suttas that are, apart from very basic and short texts, were in fact in question and answer format. There's a few exceptions to that, as always, but for the most part, we'll see that as with the Samanyapala Sutta, when we look at that, the king comes and asks a question, and it's the Buddha's answer to the question. So that question and answer format is used very extremely widely, both in terms of a genuine dialogue, but also in terms of a set of rhetorical questions and answers. So this also is used as a very prominent literary style. And what I tended to notice is that very often those question and answers concern things which were stated elsewhere as short declarative statements. Okay? So you might have one text, for example, that says, there are these four noble truths. The suffering, the origin of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the path of practice leading to the ending of suffering. And then you might have another discourse where a bhikkhu comes to the Buddha and says, the Buddha's spoken of these four noble truths, and he's spoken of the ending of suffering and the path to the ending of suffering. What did you mean when you mentioned the path to the ending of suffering? And then the Buddha will give an explanation and say, I was referring to the Noble Eightfold Path, right speech, right view, and so on. So what I suspect is that those statements where the Buddha actually sits down and gives a straightforward teaching on the five aggregates or the six sense bases or something, this is what we should regard as the sutta. And what we should regard as the vyakarana is the questions where these are being there's like question and answers where these are being asked about, discussed, explained, and clarified, and so on. Of course, it's not always possible to clearly distinguish between those two, but nevertheless, that's I think a sort of a rough guideline. Now, what this Anga theory suggests then is that not only so come back to the question which Venerable Nalaya asked earlier, is were these Angas actual like books? Were they collected? I mean, we know they weren't books in the sense of written text, but were they actually collected in that way, or were they just literary genres? The main consensus of modern scholarship has been to treat them as literary genres, and so to treat them not as an actual description of an existing canon as such, but as a set of styles which may be found somewhere within the canon. However, I'm not convinced by that argument, and I'm not convinced by that argument for one primary reason, which is that in almost every case, when we look at the existing scriptures, they are actually organized in accordance with these Angas. We find Udanas organized with other Udanas. We find Itivuttikas organized with other Itivuttikas. We find Jatakas organized with other Jatakas. Gathas organized with other Gathas. Others are not so clear, but still, for example, we have two Vedala suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, which are next to one another. We find suttas which are Buddha Dhamma suttas, again, which are next to one another, close to one another. The Gaya, the Sagata, is collected according to the traditions in the Sagata Vagga of the Samyutta Nikaya. So in almost every case where we can actually clearly identify, or relatively clearly identify, a body of work of one or other of these genres, they are in fact collected in an actual collection of that type, with that name. And so the modern theory that they are just literary genres is one which I think doesn't do justice to the way that the texts are actually organized. And also it doesn't do justice to the nature of oral literature, because I think that it would be very natural and something that would happen right from the beginning that these things would tend to be organized together, simply to make it easier to memorize them and so on. It's easy to memorize a collection of, say, 10 suttas dealing with the khandhas because they have much material in common. Why would you memorize one on the khandhas and one on dependent origination and one verse or something like that? It's much easier to memorize things that are similar and in sets. And I think that was probably one of the driving forces behind the original organization of the suttas, of the scriptures. So, if that perspective is true, then it may be the case that both the Sutta and the Vyakarana were also organized in terms of actual bodies of scripture and not merely just as styles of scripture. Now, we can't find that very sort of clearly or obviously in the canons as they exist today. But there was a hint to that given by Asanga. And Asanga in his Yogacara Bhumi Shastra explained these, and he primarily pointed to the Sutta and the Vyakarana as being contained in the Sanyutta Agama or Sanyutta Nikaya, and particularly the prose sections of it. Now, his fairly brief suggestions were then taken up and used as an analytical tool by Master Yin Shun, the recently deceased Taiwanese sutra master. And Yin Shun's theory has apparently become extremely influential in Taiwanese Buddhism to the point where it's become almost dogmatic. And yet it's almost completely unknown outside of Taiwan. So I tried to take Yin Shun's ideas insofar as I understood them. I haven't read his detailed analysis. Yin Shun did a very detailed structural analysis of the whole Sanyutta Agama and reconstructed the whole sequences of the text. And for those who are very skeptical about such procedures, I'll just submit one little story-ette, which it may help to give a little bit of faith in the worthwhileness of such procedures. When Yin Shun analyzed the Sanyutta Agama in Chinese translation, he found that there are various mistakes with it. Some bits of it were missing, others bits were mixed up, and some extra text had been incorporated, alien text had been incorporated in it. Particularly, there's a long passage from a biography of King Ashoka, which has just been sort of put in there by mistake by some unmindful novice who was looking after the monastery library one time and then got copied by unmindful copyists from then on to the present day. So he tried to sort of reconstruct what the original form of it and came up with a new sequence of suttas which differs from the existing Chinese text. And interestingly enough, at the same time that he was doing that, on the same period, there was a bunch of German archaeologists in Central Asia who were excavating manuscripts and then went back and did analysis of the manuscripts and found that there was actually a certain portion of the Sanyutta Agama in those manuscripts, and that the portions which they had, although they were only fragments, they allowed them to identify a sequence of suttas for a certain part of the Sanyutta Agama. And my friend Rod Bucknell, a scholar in Queensland, the German scholars were unaware of Yin Shun's work, and Yin Shun was unaware of the German scholars' work, and Rod Bucknell put them together and found they came up with exactly the same sequence of suttas for the Sanyutta Agama. Yin Shun working by inference and reconstructing the text, and the German scholars used by reading the manuscript.
What language
was the manuscript? In Sanskrit. Yeah. I have a few of those texts here. I'm sure if these are readable, they're quite old. They seem to be okay. So it's just a random one, a bit long, a shorter one.
These were the ones I found.
I'm not sure if these were these were from the same thing. These are the ones. These are ones which Rod has collected over the years, and put together. Collected together, so I'm not sure. See, this one's from 1916, so they're from different expeditions and so on. So, but this is just a sample of a Sanskrit text. Shramana, whatever, Samana, whatever, ascetic or Brahman, well, Stoka. Not sure what a Stoka is, but it says Mahutata, which is a moment, from moment to moment, Sarva Sattva. All beings, prana bhutesu, that's again a word for a being, and bhuta is another word for a being. Maitram chittam, that mind of loving kindness. Bhavayeyuh, should they develop a mind of loving kindness. And then there's a bit of a gap in this manuscript. Then for them, if one should approach them, Vyado. Not sure what that means. A yaksho is a yaka. Avatara, or an avatara prekshi. And should look at them. There's another gap in the text there. And then one does not gain an object. One doesn't gain something about if some yaka or something approaches and one doesn't gain an object for that would be a basis for there would be no occasion for the arising of ill will or something, I think is what it's saying. I'm not 100% sure. Anyway, that's sati sutta. It's supposed to be a correlate of this particular one here. Okay, so the Pali text says if a bhikkhu develops the mind of loving kindness and makes much of it and fully develops it and so on, then if a non-human being, a yakara or so on, which should think to overthrow their mind, then that would only reap weariness and disappointment for that non-human being. Okay, so that's a particular text. So that's just a short Sanskrit fragment, and not many of the others are much longer. So back to the Yin Shun and his work with the Angas, and Yin Shun followed up this suggestion or this hint by Asanga and found it very fruitful for helping to analyze and reconstruct the early discourses. Now Yin Shun's work was primarily on the Sanyutta Nikaya and Sanyutta Agama. Yin Shun's theory was actually that the sutras were the main sanyutas. So, for example, the Kandha Sanyutta, the Nidana Sanyutta, Salayatana Sanyutta, dealing with the major doctrinal topics, and the Vyakarana were the minor sanyutas. So these are the ones like we've just been reading from here. And in the sanyutas you have the major sanyutta here, Nidana Sanyutta, and then a whole bunch of relatively minor ones, the Kassapa Sanyutta with Venerable Mahakassapa, Rahula Sanyutta, and so on. That's how Yin Shun analyzed it following Asanga. But it seems to me more likely that the Sutta and Vyakarana actually refer to the short declarative discourses on a topic, and Vyakarana refer to the question and answers on that same topic. So both of them might be found within the same Sanyutta. And what I noticed was that in certain cases it actually does seem very much to be like that. And for example, in the Salayatana Sanyutta, more or less the first 50 suttas are all sutras. They're all just the Buddha sitting down and saying these six senses are impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering is not self, and so on. So it's short, very pithy statements like that. And then in more or less the 51st sutta, a bhikkhu approaches the Buddha and says, when such and such is impermanent, what do you mean by that? And so we introduce to the Vyakarana. And when I began to look closer and closer at the Sanyutta Nikaya, and especially comparing it with the Pali and the Chinese, it seems to me that's how it was originally constructed, that the sutra sections were originally it was originally organized with each section, so there'd be a whole selection of sutras on, for example, the five khandhas, and then the vyakaranas or the explanations on those five khandhas. And that particular organization has been largely lost, but there are hints of it remaining. So this was my kind of sort of slight development of Yin Shun's idea on the three angas in the Sanyutta Nikaya. Now, there's two main points that arise from that. One point is, well, what happens to the other Nikayas? If these three are primarily the Sanyutta Nikaya, and if these remaining angas are primarily the Kuddha Nikaya, what about the Digha? What about the Majjhima? What about the Anguttara? Apparently, Rod told me one time that he travelled to Taiwan and actually went to see Yin Shun to ask him this question. But Yin Shun was like 100 years old at that time and wasn't into giving detailed technical answers, so he didn't get much of a response to it. What I would say is most likely the answer that I work on as a kind of working hypothesis is this, that in the earliest times the texts were organized according to these different literary styles. Gradually, of course, as the Buddha taught more and more suttas would be added, the texts were growing, and it became more and more difficult to actually memorize such a large body of texts and to organize the process of memorizing them. Now, when the Buddha passed away, the Sangha gathered together in the councils, jobs of the council was to ensure that the texts were organized and redacted properly and that they would be memorized and passed down accurately. There's even a remark in the Pali commentary to the first council where it says that in selecting the bhikkhus to attend the first council, of course no bhikkhuni is present, but in selecting the bhikkhus that Mahakasapa actually rejected those monks who were experts in the angas and only accepted those who were experts in the nikayas. So what I think is that's a suggestion is that it was maybe in the councils, perhaps starting with the first council, perhaps the second council, that this new organizational strategy was developed. And the primary reason for it was to divide the nikayas into relatively manageable, divide the scriptures into relatively manageable chunks so that they could be organized for their recitation purposes. Now, that must have been what we know is that every school of Buddhism has a similar system of four or five nikayas and agamas. So we assume that the system dates from before the time of the schisms. And yet the way that things are organized within those nikayas or agamas is actually quite different. So they'll have different suttas in the Digha as opposed to the Majjhima. They'll have different suttas in the Sanyutta or the Anguttara. So most likely they had a general agreement on that system, but in each individual monastery they worked out the details of that differently. Quite possibly, yeah. There may have been some competition about different ways of using it, as is very normal. Just like today, you'll find some monks say, they prefer to read suttas on paper, and others will say they prefer to read it on the computer. So,
Mac versus
Windows. Exactly.
So it's the same.
It's evolution.
Very similar. The same text, but organized in different
ways. Yes, except that inevitably changes must be introduced. Yeah, whenever you reorganize it, it's going to be changed somehow, even if that's kept to a minimum.
If you identify the angas with the same nikayas, it doesn't have to answer the question where the materials to the other.
Right, which is what I'm going to get onto in a minute. Yeah. So that's the first idea, is that there was this gradual change from the angas to the nikayas or agamas. Better to use the word agamas actually. When we're talking about these things, in Pali we tend to use the word Nikaya. Actually, Agama is a much better word. Agama is actually used in the suttas themselves as a word for scriptures. It's much less ambiguous. It's Nikaya is also used of schools of Buddhism, so it's quite a confusing terminology. So Anga is actually a much better one.
So anyway. Anga
and Agama. Sorry. Agama and Nikaya. Agama and Nikaya is different. Agama and Anga are different. The word agama is used in the suttas, but only in the sense of a general sense of a scripture. not in terms of a specific collection. Okay, so come back to the question, how did the Angas develop into the Agamas or the Nikayas? What I think happened was that if you look at certain of the, I think we get a clue if we look at certain of the Nikayas as they exist today. So we look at one of the clearest examples is the Sila Kandha Wagga Pali. So the Sila obviously is virtue, Kanda is the mass or the collection, group of virtue, Wagga is the chapter. And the Sila Kandha Wagga have a list of 13 suttas, of which the second one, Samanyapala Sutta, is what we'll be studying in the next weeks. Now, the reason these are collected together is because each one of them has a large passage dealing with sila, and we'll look at that in some detail. Now, that long passage dealing with sila is obviously the reason why the chapter is called the Sila Kandha Wagga, and that it's also not just a teaching on sila, but is also framed within a larger teaching on sila, samadhi, panya. Okay, so we have the threefold training: virtue, concentration, wisdom. Now, each of these addresses that in an extended form. Now, the fact that they're all collected together means, of course, you can abbreviate. So actually, after the Samanyapala Sutta, most of the rest of them just say, and everything should be expanded as with the Samanyapala Sutta. They have their own individual backgrounds and settings and so on, but then the same passage is repeated. So that arrangement, where you have a large group of texts with a lot in common, dealing with much textual material shared and dealing with the same kinds of topics, is very reminiscent of the Sanyutta Nikaya. Because in the Sanyutta we similarly find that the khandas, all the suttas on the khandas all put together, all the suttas on the six sense bases put together. So what I'd suggest is that this particular group of texts is like a Sanyutta which has been broken off from the Sanyutta Agama and brought into the Digha Nikaya. And that particular group of texts, that 13 texts, is interestingly enough also found in other versions of the Digha Nikaya or Dirgha Agama. And so here's a comparative table on the structure of the Dirgha Agama in the Sarvastivada or Mula Sarvastivada tradition. Now here, this starts out with this series of discourses, which I won't go into right now. And here, where are we going now? Yeah, so we have the down here. It's almost like reversed. Almost like reversed in this one. Starts out, the last one is the Brahmajala. You can see the similarities just by looking at the numbers here, because these numbers refer to the numbers in the Pali Canon, and they're all in the first 13 suttas, which is the first Wagga. So 1, 8, 13, 2, 10, 9, 3, 5, 6, 7, 11, 12, and so on. So in other words, the last group of suttas in the Sanskrit version corresponds roughly with the first group of suttas in the Pali. But that's right, that's the Sanskrit ones. Now this is the Sanskrit Dirgha Agama.
Dirgha Agama.
Yeah, so they both... Okay. So here we have on the left the Sarvastivada or Mula Sarvastivada Dirgha Agama, okay? And that's presented together with the corresponding suttas here from the Pali Digha Nikaya. And when we look at the last, leaving aside those first, but the last group of texts, starting with this one, Lohitya, we find that all of these ones when they have Pali parallels, of course it's messy because these things are always messy, but the ones that have Pali parallels are all found within the first 13 suttas in the Digha Nikaya. I'll come back to that in a second. Yeah? So just to notice that these two are connected. Yeah? So you can see how they're all from the same... Basically, you have a similar group of suttas found together in the two different collections. Does that make sense?
And all of the ones in this Digha, I don't know. Yeah? Is that the whole...
That's the complete list. That's the complete list in the correct order.
So the only correspondence is in the...
In the earlier parts of it, we find the later suttas. Yeah, so these ones found here, but that's basically it's upside down. Exactly. Yeah. Okay, and we find a similar thing if we look in the Chinese. This one, this center column here, is the Gandhari Dharmaguptaka Dirgha Agama. And without going into too much detail, but you can also see that the numbers here are similar. These are also within the same collection. Yeah? So they find similar numbers together for the most part. So these are all in the 20s. So it's more or less the first 10 or so suttas in the Pali, and then the third group in the Sanskrit and the Dharmaguptaka versions. So what that suggests to me is that that group of texts, roughly 12 or so suttas dealing with the threefold training in a lot of detail, pre-existed the Digha Nikaya or Dirgha Agama. Okay? It's like a textual unit which has been taken over and placed in there in one form or another. Reshuffled and so on, but still recognizable. And so what I would suggest is that that's originally was a samyutta. It's very much the form of a samyutta and may well have formed an independent samyutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. Samyutta is a collection or a body of texts all dealing with the same topic. Yeah, collection of topic. Yeah? So it's very much the same kind of thing. Now the interesting thing is that in the Samyutta Nikaya as we have it today, we don't have any Samyutta that deals with the threefold training. Now that's curious, isn't it? Don't you think that's a bit odd?
Not as it's in the Digha.
Well, exactly. but otherwise, it's a bit odd, isn't it? We've got the five khandhas, we've got the four noble truths, we've got the eightfold path, we've got every major numerical group we could want is represented by its own Samyutta. But not the threefold training.
That's very nice. So basically your theory is that everything was samyutta at once at that
point.
And then they redivided it by taking the long one to another, to the Digha and the middle one. So imagine the structure
of the samyutta. Yeah. And in some cases it may have gone in both directions. So for example in the threefold training suttas, there's actually another group of them, again all clumped together in the threes of the Anguttara Nikaya, and they're the shorter ones. So, you know, again, it's just a speculation, but the speculation is that originally there was a Samyutta which had the Sutta, which is the shorter suttas on the threefold training, and then the Vyakarana, which would be the long ones, and the shorter ones were taken out into the Anguttara, and the long ones taken into the Digha.
It's just a little bit abstract here, because we have these from books, and you've named the books.
Absolutely, that oral tradition makes a big impact on it. Yeah.
This reminds me, being a person who was involved in computing in the days when memory was limited, This is exactly how you organise
in order to minimise your memory.
Yeah. And nowadays, it can't be worse. memory's cheap. So we used memory was slow. And it was limited and it was expensive.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest problems in programming back then, 20 years ago, was having great lists or lots and lots of information, and it was fine as long as nobody changed it. As soon as you started trying to put in new information, you had to come up with strategies like this, and you can lose things, and it's interesting. I've often reflected before on the way that seeing how the new codes are organized. Mm. It seems to be like that, and it's not like writing.
It's information technology, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Mm. It is. And I'm imagining this group of monks or bhikkhus and bhikkhunis trying to learn all this, and suddenly trying to go, I can't learn anymore. And they put it
and trying to nut it out.
Give it to somebody else.
I mean, it's an extraordinary thing to think of, just to be able to know it all, and we can put it all on a page in front of us, but to have it in your mind, to actually sit around and discuss, how are you going to organise, and so it's very unsurprising that there are these variations in it. But it's remarkable how they've managed to keep things so consistent. But Ananda was going to say something. You had a comment earlier? Did you have a comment earlier? I thought you were going to say something.
I want to share the comment in the report in the first Buddhist Council. The report that different group of people had to travel to Ananda, to Mamma, even Nikana, travel of Anuruka, woman from Mamma Rani, from the Tanikana, and to the travel of Kashapa, woman from Mamma Rani. So they go on, maybe they memorize according to the guru, and the guru of Bhavana, Bharana.
Bhavana.
One group remembers only one chapter of what the Buddha taught. And later on, your monk, maybe a third generation.
Yeah.
And the third generation, they may distribute it, they belong somewhere in India. And each party has only a half. So, in the early at the time, the travel and one of the Buddhist council, they can't call all the section of the money at all over India to come together. I don't know if they can call all of them come together.
Mm.
So, they want to let the collection, maybe like paper printing, because they can't call all together.
Absolutely, And you have certain sutras maybe in one town. That not memorized in another town?
And one of the reports that there are bamboo Purana?
Yeah.
Yes, it is a bamboo castle. And he said, I am content with what I heard from the Buddha world, and I've read it yet. And he had over 500 disciples, and he taught his disciples what he heard from other.
Yeah, from the castle,
So it might be.
You'd always have the two tendencies. The tendency in the councils would be to bring everything together, centralize it and standardize it.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you have those other tendencies with the things would be different and individual and so on. So both happening at the same time. What a headache. What a headache. Understand differently. Some will disagree, some agree. Yeah, very much.
So what was
your first
rupee?
Well, the earliest record of it being written is in the in Sri Lanka, about 20 BC.
Yeah,
we have 400 years.
More than 400 years after the Buddha passed away.
Yeah.
And it was committed to write.
Yeah.
So more than 400 years.
I have a chance to remember it, but yeah.
And people now wonder, your mind now, Arahant mind now, he too much of he belonged to in India because he was born around 250 years after the Buddha. So yet at that time, the Buddha Yamaha is divided into different shells. And too much shell he actually belonged, and what language he actually knew when he when he first came to Pitaka to Chinanda.
If you want to know that it's cheap in Jayanta and come
back to Radha now,
now we have a
family
thing with
Maybe
one
by Arahant Mahina, which I have a family.
True, it's quite far from
it. Quite far from it. Just to come back to that thing you mentioned before about the different disciples. Their students practicing each Nikaya. I think there's probably some truth to that. And if you said that the Ananda students taught the Digha Nikaya, now here's the first group of suttas in the Dirgha Agama, and actually quite a lot of them, these ones are doctrinal compilations, but these ones, Chatushparisat, Mahavadana and Mahaparinirvana, are very much biographical stories of the Buddha's life. And they're exactly the kind of thing that Ananda would have liked very much, yeah? Where he featured a lot in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta.
This is so much speculation.
Yeah.
But it may be because Ananda and his disciples were advised the path of memorizing
and
then go to his disciples and his disciples to Ananda disciples to generation to generation.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a tie of Vida Nibbana.
It's more devotional.
More ancient.
So this is just a suggestion. Now, it's obviously complex to work that suggestion out methodically. There are other places where you can find similar kinds of pattern. There are many other cases where you can't. But one other complicating thing here is also the role of the Gaya, being the mixed prose and verse discourse identified with Sagatawagga. Now in Sagatawagga, in the prose discourse in the Samyutta, things are organized according to topic, the khandhas, salayatana, dependent origination and so on. Whereas in the Sagatawagga, things are organized according to person. Okay, so it might be the collection on devatas, or the collection on kings, the collection on bhikkhus or bhikkhunis. So it's a personal way of organizing things. But we also find that also carries over into the other collections. So for example, the last several Majjhima suttas we read were from like the Raja Samyutta, yeah, the collection, the Raja Vagga, with the selection on kings. And so that seems to be similar to the style that's organized here in the Gaya section of Sagatawagga. So, if that suggestion has any cogency, then it works quite nicely, or meshes quite nicely with another kind of observation about the nature of the Samyutta Nikaya as a whole. Again, coming back to the main prose sections of the Samyutta Nikaya. Now, if we look in these ones, leaving aside the minor ones, here we have the Nidana Samyutta dealing with dependent origination. The Khanda Samyutta, of course, the five khandas, Salayatana Samyutta, the six senses. And then the Mahavagga or Magavagga is dealing with the various sets of dhammas associated with the path, the Eightfold Path, Seven Factors of Awakening, Satipatthana, and so on. These are mainly what we call the 37 Bodhipakya dhammas, with a few extra things thrown in there as well, but those things dealing with the path. Now, what seems to me, and it was suggested by Bhikkhu Bodhi, is that these major topics in the Samyutta organize themselves quite nicely into the Four Noble Truths. And in fact, the final Samyutta is the Satcha Samyutta, dealing with the Four Noble Truths. And again, the evolution and different forms of it is quite complex in the different versions, but what I would suggest is that the the structure of the Saṅyutta Nikāya, and hence the structure, if I'm correct, of the early Buddhist scriptures as a whole, was constructed using the Four Noble Truths as an overarching template. So that under the first noble truth is the first noble truth of suffering, and under that is primarily the Buddhist, of course, said the Panchupadana Khanda in the first sermon. So remember the first Buddhist first discourse, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which is included here in the Saccha Saṅyutta, and he says in brief, the five aggregates of grasping are suffering. Panchupadana Khanda Dukkha. Now, in a sense, we can see the whole of the Khanda Saṅyutta, which has hundreds of suttas in it, as being like a commentary or an expansion of that one statement in the first discourse. Okay? Can you see the idea that I'm getting at here? Similarly, the Khanda Saṅyutta is constructed very much parallel with the Salayatana Saṅyutta. We find many of the same kinds of suttas there. And they're both considered as explanations of the primarily first noble truth. Dependent origination, on the other hand, in the Nidana Saṅyutta is primarily felt to be a description of the second and third noble truths, the origin of suffering and the ending of suffering. It's an expanded explanation of those two noble truths. And, of course, the fourth noble truth is the truth of the path, and then that's all those found here in the Mahavagga or Magavagga of the Saṅyutta Nikāya. So, again, this suggestion is that the overall template, and this was described quite well by Bhikkhu Bodhi in his introduction to his translation of the Saṅyutta, that the overall template of the Saṅyutta is organized according to the Four Noble Truths, and that within that the discourses are organized firstly according to topic, so all the Khanda suttas together, and secondly according to literary style, so with the two angas, the sutra and the vyākarana, organized within that. Sutra is the declarative and the vyākarana, the interrogative discourses. And so I think that's a really kind of nice way of looking at the suttas, and I find it also a very useful way, because what it says is that for the earliest redactors, that they regarded as the four noble truths as being the overarching and main teaching of the Buddha, and one in which quite literally the Buddha said all of my teachings can be encompassed within the four noble truths. You know, these things are said many times, and so they took that very literally, and they actually quite literally organized the categories of this teaching to fit within the four noble truths. And so again, of course, it's not completely neat. Of course, there are exceptions and variations and so on, which is hardly unusual when you're dealing with this many scriptures. But what I think is quite extraordinary is the extent to which that program was able to be carried out, and the clarity with which this organization was thought about. So to me, this was very nice to be able to think of this, because it gave me it has a number of implications. One implication was that the people who were organizing this canon knew what they were doing, that there is an order there, which is sometimes not that obvious, because sometimes when you're reading the suttas, it gets a bit frustrating. Like, why is this one after that one? And you can't really understand why it's been organized that way. So this suggests that in its earliest form, it was constructed very carefully and very thoughtfully. The second thing is that it tells us that the Four Noble Truths were very central. This may be unspectacular for people here, but it's actually been seriously argued by some modern Buddhist scholars that the Four Noble Truths are actually a later interpolation into Buddhism. Okay, so this was one of C.F. Rhys-David's kind of slightly kooky theories, but it seems to me that this way of looking at it really puts the Four Noble Truths back in the center of things. Which is also in conformity with the interpretive procedures which were developed by the schools themselves. And we have those interpretive procedures in certain of the later books in the Khuddaka Nikaya, particularly the Netti and the Petakopadesa, And these are essentially guidebooks in how to read and interpret the Pali Canon. And they both use the Four Noble Truths as their primary interpretive strategy. In other words, when you pick up any sutta, the first question you ask is, where does this fit into the Four Noble Truths?
Explain how that collection is organized by the Four Noble
Truths. Okay. No, that's not simple. We're looking primarily at the Samyutta. So the Khanda and Salayatana are the first noble truth, because the Buddha said Panchupadana Khanda Dukkha. Yeah. Nidana means cause. So that's the cause of suffering. Yeah. And of course, the opposite is the ending of suffering, because that's the dependent origination. And then the Mahavagga, all of these ones are dealing with the path. Yeah. So here, it's very, very clear. And then, of course, in the other ones, it's much less clear that they've already been broken up and so on. And that's another very good question. And it doesn't all that well. And there needs to be a lot more detailed inquiry to figure that out. In some cases, you can look at things in the Anguttara and see, like I mentioned before, say the suttas on the threefold training, and that they could certainly belong within a Samyutta-style structure. Others don't. Quite likely, you know, a lot of them all kind of miscellaneous or one-off or personal or idiosyncratic teachings given to particular people at different places and times, which, you know, weren't so easily put in within the main framework.
To be
canonical, yeah. The Anguttara is generally considered to be, on average, a bit later than the other Nikayas or Agamas. And, it's not very obvious, but for example, it uses certain technical vocabulary that's not found elsewhere, and there's certain things about it. But also, there's very little correlation between the Pali Anguttara and the Chinese Ekotara Agama, which makes it much more difficult to do that kind of detailed studies. It's not exactly sure why that is, but so the Anguttara, I haven't studied done the comparative study of the Angutturas enough to be able to really look at it, and I suspect it'd be difficult to do that because of that lack of good comparative material. Yeah. So the other practical implication of that way of looking at the text is that very, very simply, if we want to answer a question, and so, for example, this all came up in the context of looking at the four Satipatthanas, and so if I want to answer a question, first place I go to is to the Samyutta Nikaya. If I want to know the answer to any question on any basic Buddhist doctrine, and then I look in the Samyutta Nikaya, and I look here, it has the Satipatthana Samyutta, and I look at the Satipatthana Samyutta, and I start and have a look at the suttas there. And that's a very useful principle, simply because it's the opposite principle to what most people actually, in fact, follow. So most people, if they're studying, for example, Satipatthana, will read the Satipatthana Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya and ignore everything else. Or if they do look at everything else, then it will be a fairly minor detail. Whereas this way of reading the text would say, no, look first of all at the suttas in the Samyutta, look first of all at the short, simple, declarative statements, the ones that belong to the sutta category, then go from there to look at the longer ones in a question and answer format, and from there look at the long and detailed developed suttas in the Majjhima and the Digha. Okay?
Like you said, the
Majjhima
is probably more things.
Yeah.
More
yeah.
Approach.
Yeah.
Why is
what?
Why not the Samyutta, which seems to be a lot more basic?
Yeah, I think it's because Majjhima is more readable.
Mm.
Sanyutta is great. Sanyutta is terrific, and it's a big, again, it's a difference between oral and written literature. To read a Majjhima Sutta, I find, for most people, I think is much more satisfying. It's more like a short story or something. Well, you're a bit unusual. Most people find it like that. Whereas actually for reciting, the Sanyutta Suttas are terrific because they're not too long and they're easy to memorize and stuff.
Yeah. The Majjhima, it's nice to pick up and just read.
Yeah,
read
like a story.
But if you've got something that you really want to know, you've got this Sanyutta.
Yeah.
Because
it's organized.
Got the answers,
yeah.
And it's all laid out and it's organized.
Yeah.
I think it's natural for the Buddha. Sometimes you don't. You give Dhamma talk to one person longer, and sometimes you give Dhamma talk to another person shorter. Mm. It depends on the intellectual level of the listener. He gives a long talk to talk. Sometimes you talk to the farmer, he gives the farmer language. But he talks to a very high intellectual Brahmin.
Yeah.
He is a very, usually, it is called in the Diganikadan.
That's a good point. So everyone understand that particular point. I'd say two things. I think that's obviously correct, right? But I also think it's incomplete as an explanation for how the scriptures have got to be as they are. And I think there are two things I'd say to that. One is that you said that the suttas, for example, the Digha Sutta is often given to very intellectual Brahmins and so on. And hence a longer rather than, say, Sanyutta discourses. Now, there is some truth to that, but also most of the Sanyutta discourses are actually given to the bhikkhus.
Yeah,
you could argue the opposite way. You could say that Sanyutta discourses are given to bhikkhus, because most of the Sanyutta discourses in the Digha are actually given to lay people.
Yeah?
To the bhikkhus. Yeah, well, a lot of both, yeah.
Many and two, you wonder.
Yeah, a lot of both,
so it depends on the intellectual level of the audience, it's a different cause.
That's obviously an important factor, so I'm not trying to say that's not. But the other problem there is that we know for a fact that these things have changed a lot through the redaction. We look at the different versions of it in Pali, Sanskrit, Chinese, Tibetan, and they're all different. And so we know that there are editorial processes involved, and it can't be explained solely in terms of the different tendencies of individuals.
Yes, it's of course, it undergo a very long process of the edition.
Yeah, they're both things, considerations to bear in mind when reading, yeah? Very.
So we will not have a one-child view when we come to
Absolutely, yeah. There are so many influences and forces at work So we should always be open to looking at things from as many different perspectives as we can. So, you know, to summarize that, but I was saying that the traditions, within the traditions themselves, have explanations for these things. And they will talk about it in the commentaries, for example, why it talks in this way, why this one's in question format, why this one is in length and this one's brief. And so that gives some explanation for why there's the diversity in the teachings as well. Yeah.
If you're suggesting that they take a whole section from the Samyutta and putting it into Majjhimadhyamaka, are you also kind of suggesting that, because originally they're probably not that long, by the time they go to Diga, then they just add whatever they think is...
It may have been at any time in that process. Quite likely they were already pretty long discourses, and then they might have been expanded further. Yeah. But you do find that the different Diga suttas in the different schools, they have differences, but they are of comparable length most of the time. Yeah. Oh, that's not always the case. We'll see that with the Samanyapada Sutta, that there are both short and long versions of the same sutta.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking that if it's originally from the Samyutta, and not many of them are, they're not necessarily the same length, or they're not necessarily really long.
Right.
Then if you suddenly put it in the Diga, then that means each one of them at least have to be a certain length to be in the Diga.
Yeah.
So that means, you know, in that process you can say the Diga contains more material that is extra.
Yeah, and in some cases, that's being negotiated in various ways. So, for example, if you in the Pali Diga, all of the suttas are actually quite long, except for a few which are abbreviated so much that there's not much left of them. But in the Mulasarasivada Diga, which is the Sanskrit one here, actually some of them are quite short. So even though it's mostly long suttas, but there are a few Majjhima-length suttas and a few even Sanyutta or Anguttara-length suttas. So it wasn't like an absolute criterion. But the other thing is that what I think has happened is that in certain cases suttas have actually been constructed specifically to be long in order to be included in the Digha Nikaya. And I think the most obvious example of that is the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, where you get the Majjhima length Satipatthana Sutta, which would already be too long for a Sanyutta discourse. And then you put another Majjhima discourse, this is such a Vibhanga Sutta, and put those two together to make a Digha discourse.
Yeah.
Right, and if you look in here, the Chunky Sutta, where are we? Chunky, it's got a different name in Sanskrit. Where are we? Oh yeah, 95. Yeah, it has a different name in the Sanskrit recension, but that's in the Dirga Agama. Yeah. Yeah, same with Mahasachika. There's also a long sutra in the Majjhima, and then that chart here. But again, this is also interesting because these Majjhima suttas are also clustered together, aren't they? So all the Majjhima ones are put together in the Diga. So it's interesting. Ah, somebody gave it to me. I can give you a copy if you want.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very fascinating article. Yeah. So to then come back to the organizational question that I mentioned was coming to from the beginning. When we look at the Samanyapala Sutta, Digha Nikaya 2, and that's what I've given a general explanation of how that group of texts has been, I believe, sort of formed originally as a Sanyutta-style group with around the theme of the threefold training, and then the longest of those threefold trainings, some of them were put in the Majjhimas, the shorter ones in the Anguttara, and the longest ones in the Digha, ending with roughly a dozen suttas in the Digha Nikaya or Dirgha Agama. on the threefold training. Now, then the question comes, why are these particular suttas at the beginning, and why are there the differences between the different versions? Oh, I shouldn't have closed that. So in the Pali, the Digha Nikaya starts with the Brahmajala Sutta and then goes to the Samanyapala Sutta, number 2, whereas in the Mudassarvasivada version, it starts with this group of 6. Now, this group of 6 is not found as an actual group of 6 in the Pali canon, but it's actually found independently as an independent group of 6 sutras quite frequently in the northern manuscripts that have been found. This grouping is quite well attested. And it's actually quite an interesting little grouping. These 3, Dashottara, Atharvashtara, and Sangiti, are more or less doctrinal compilations. So they're just collections of dhammas organized according to numerical form in Anguttara style. And these 3 are all the essential suttas on the Buddha's biography. The Chattisparisat Sutra tells the story from the Buddha's enlightenment up to the establishment of the 4 assemblies. The Mahavadana tells of the Buddha's past lives and so on. And the Mahaparinivana tells of the Buddha's final days. These are the main biographical discourses. And so that's quite a nice little collection. It would include, it's got the human interest sort of popular suttas, and also very handy doctrinal compilations. So it's kind of useful if, you know, if you're only learning 6 suttas, you could learn those six suttas, and you'd be able to tell all the main stories about the Buddha's life, and you'd be able to know most of the collections of Buddha's doctrines. So this is quite a rational and straightforward way, and we can see why these ones would be included here at the beginning of the Sanskrit Dirgha Agama. But when we look at the Sila Kanda, it's not at all obvious why these particular suttas are included here, why they're at the beginning, why they're at the beginning of the whole Pali system and everything like that. Commentary explains that and says that the Brahmajala Sutta is put at number 1 because it's the net of views, 62 kinds of wrong views. So this is like the roaring lions at the gateway to the Dhamma. Okay, so this is scaring off all the heretics and people of wrong view, and they come along and they see the Brahmajala Sutta and they're immediately so terrified that they flee, which is perhaps a particularly Theravadan approach to take to scriptural study. And I think there's probably something to that, but just to say my own particular feeling on this is that I talked about this in sect and sectarianism, is that if you look at the story of the Third Council, which is only found in the Pali tradition, Sri Lankan tradition, the story of the Third Council says that there were a lot of heretics teaching all kinds of wrong views that had entered the Sangha, and that there was a council or a meeting held under the leadership of Moggaliputta and sponsored by King Ashoka, whose job was to eject the heretics from the Sangha. And in that description of that, when it lists the heretical views of the non-Buddhists in the Sangha, it lists precisely the 62 kinds of wrong views found in the Brahmajala Sutta. Okay? Which is it's a highly artificial kind of construction, but that's how it's depicted. And it also seems to me that the Samanyapala Sutta also has a strong linkage with the life of King Ashoka, because as we'll see with the Samanyapala Sutta, is the story of redemption of a great king of Magadha. And King Ashoka was also a great king of Magadha who committed terrible crimes and was in great need of redemption. And so I wonder whether it was actually the influence of the redactors of the Third Council who was influenced behind placing these particular suttas at the beginning here. Okay. So again, I'm just making that suggestion as to why there is these different organizational patterns. And so that to me suggests that the organization of the Diga in the Pali tradition was influenced by the Third Council, maybe 150 years after the Buddha. So. Well, exactly. And that would seem to be the obvious one. And that would be the case in the Anga system, is that the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta would be in the first sutta dealing with the Four Noble Truths, and that would stand right at the head of everything.
Yeah, it's not even the first
sutta. No, it's actually in the last sanyutta. So, but again, that's that same phenomenon that we saw with this the Sila Khandavaga. It's the first in the Pali and the last in others,
mm-hmm.
so that they can get swapped. The whole thing does get swapped backwards and forwards. And so in that case, the Satya Sanyutta is at the end, whereas in other places at the first. In the Sarvasivadin text on the First Council, it actually states that the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta was the first sutta spoken at the First Council. So the Pali says it was the Brahmajala, whereas the Sarvasivadins and the Sarvasivadins say it was the Dhammacakka. So again, much more plausible.
We can think of the temple of Ananda with memory and the temple of Ananda.
Not good memory.
Yes, that's why. Then memorize the shorter thing.
The Indian, well, I don't think it's going to really mind much about putting things in like temporal order on, you know, historical, you know. First things comes first and last is last. In a you know in a sense of time.
Yes.
Yes. Here it is much more.
No, that's very true.
Because they're much more interested. I mean, the Indians didn't write down their history.
That's very true.
They're
yeah.
Much more concerned about recording things as they happen. But I don't think Brahmaja was starting off with right views, talking about right views, like if he organises something called you know,
to the Angkor Path, it still fits, doesn't it? Yeah.
Seems to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just chronological, I'd say, the main teaching.
Yeah, the Dhammacakka, yeah.
Yeah, but why would you have to put the main teaching first? Like if you...
Okay, if I can come back to that. That question of the position of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, because I think that's very important. Now, I mentioned before it's in the Sanyutta, Satya Sanyutta. We'll just have a look at, where are we now? It's up there. It's also, oh no, it should have been on Sutta Central. It's also in the plus right down the bottom here, and it's actually 56.11.
Yeah, it's not even the first
in the... Now, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But again, it's the first in the second Vagga, so perhaps isn't this whole Vagga might have been put there as a whole. See all the texts are organized in terms in groups of 10.
Mm-hmm.
10 is a Vagga. So the 11 is the first Vagga, but another one's been bung beforehand. So there's evidence that this is what happens, that things move around. Like with the Sila Khanda Vagga, it moved around as a whole Vagga. So the fact here may have been actually originally the first one. Now here's the various parallels of it, and you see how many parallels there are, not only found in the Sanyutta, but found also these ones in the Vinayas. And also in various Buddhist biographies and things like that. Yeah, that's got a star on it. That's like an analysis or of it. It's not the literal sutta. It's a similar sutta, related one. Yeah. Now here you have what's called the Chaturish Parisat Sutta, the four assemblies. Now that is essentially similar to the first chapter of the Pali Khandakas. And I actually found this just the other day. What is it called? The Sutra Foundation for Assemblies. If anybody's interested, I believe... No. description of the four. Foundation of the Buddhist Order, yeah. It's actually on Google Books and has a reasonable amount of the actual text there. And so this is the Sanskrit, reconstructed Sanskrit manuscript, similar to the first chapter of the Pali Khandaka, the Mahavagga of the Khandaka. And fascinating story, of course, having much of the same details. And here's the blah 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 first sermon, Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. At that time, the Lord addressed the five monks as follows: "O monks, when I thoroughly meditated on these things, unheard of before, the insight arose in me. This suffering is a noble truth, and knowledge, wisdom, and understanding arose. Suffering, the origin of suffering, cessation, and the path, a noble truth to be comprehended by wisdom." And so on. So it goes through teaching the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. So that's actually, if the question was about the chronological sequence of things. So this Chattisparisad Sutra actually gives the chronological sequence. And in that chronological sequence, it's the Dhammacakka which comes first. And the interesting thing is that that can be imagined that's the seed, that's the starting point for the Satya Samyutta. You know, the collection on the Four Noble Truths. The second discourse that's taught is the Anattalakkhana Sutta, which is on the five khandhas. That's also in the Chattisparisad Sutta, and that's found within the Khanda Samyutta.
Okay.
No, because the Dhammacakka is down here. The Dhammacakka is down here in the Mahavagga, mm-hmm. and the Khanda Samyutta is here. So the order of these has been mixed up. Third discourse is then the Fired Sermon, which is on the Samayatana, the six senses. And there's also another discourse which is just a little bit earlier, actually, just after the Buddha's awakening, he was said to reflect on dependent origination, is the Nidanavagga. So in that kind of earliest phase of the Buddha's teachings, when they constructed that story, it's like they put the seeds, almost like the titles, of each of these major sanyutas there, sort of chronologically appearing. It's almost like, you always think of them like as hot links, you know? You get to that one, you get to the Satcha, oh, I want to know more about the Four Noble Truths, I'll click on that, and then that takes me through to the Satcha Sangyutta and so on.
Yeah.
And then you explain them. Yeah.
But in that particular thing,
the Chattisparisad Sutra? Yeah. Chattush Parisad. Parisad. Yeah.
That actually has the text of.
Yes. Yeah. I have that in. Seems like.
Oh, it's just. Yeah, but it's. The anthology, a bit like.
Uh-huh.
In the Buddha's words, by the anthology, you know, it's got to collect all these useful things together. If your memory is not all that terrific and you can't learn the whole.
Yeah. Take a little bit, yeah. Absolutely, and that's how they taught, and that's another factor, as well as the factor of the intelligence of the person who it was originally spoken to. The other factor is the capacity of the ones who were learning it. Because some would be able to learn the whole Nikaya, or the whole Tripitaka, others could maybe only learn one or two suttas, yeah. So what they say, what they explain in the Barnaka system, they say that that typically what they would do is each Nikaya has a list of primary texts, and this is given in the commentaries. I can't remember what they are for each Nikaya, but there's like a certain list of suttas which, if you were assigned to that Nikaya, say I was assigned to the Digha Nikaya, there would be a certain list of suttas there, the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, the Samanyapala Sutta, and so on, which everyone would have to learn, and then some may go on to memorize a whole Vagga, and some may go on to memorize the whole Nikaya. And then there would be a different group of monks who were then doing the Majjhima, and a different group doing the Samyutta, and of course those who were very talented would then do not just one, but do more than one Nikaya. And then there'd be a few exceptional ones who would do the whole thing. And so that's how they divided everything up to make sure that everyone got a good education.
A thousand years' time,
when
because somebody or other is giving a presentation
about how to practice the Four Noble Truths on a spaceship.
Yes. Although they could take the that little book, that little red book that's got notes in the video, that's got a lot of different chanting.
Yeah.
They could say, this was, because that's got all of those
sisters,
and they're all sort of put together as if they're a collection.
Yeah.
But it's really just for convenience because it's ones that people like to chant. And it's important.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, that those other ones might have just sort of evolved like that somehow.
Yeah. Yeah.
As they were being translated and written down.
Definitely.
Sorry, I wasn't clear. What was your suggestion about why the first discourse is so late in the Samhita? What was your
Now I'd have to. It's been a while since I've studied it, so I can't remember all the details. But I believe, if I remember properly, that in some Sanghita, I think maybe in the Chinese, it's actually the first discourse in the section on the Four Noble Truths. Okay, in the Pali, it's number 11. So it may have originally been the first discourse in the section on the Four Noble Truths, but it actually appears to be like at the end. Okay, so it's in the last Sanghita, whereas perhaps if we'd organize it rationally, we might think it should be in the first one. Now I can't remember the exact details, but my friend Rob Bucknell did extensive work on this question of the sequences of things, and what he found out was that there were actually quite a few cases where the order of a group of texts would be flipped over from backwards to forwards. And I'm just trying to think of what the explanation for that was. He gave an explanation for it. I can't remember, but that was I can't quite recall the details for that, but that was the, but if you like I can have a look that up and check that. I
was just wondering if it's also possible that according to the Chinese the Buddha thought that the Buddha actually died before the Samhita Chakravartana Sutta first. Was the Hawaiian and all those different teachings which came first?
That wouldn't have affected it, no. That would have affected how they organized their Taisho canon, but in terms of the Sanyukta Agama itself, they just translated the text. So the Chinese, most of the time, they didn't mess around with the actual translations.
The Chinese compilation of the Mahayana is Agamana, your first teaching of the Buddha. Yeah. Your first teaching concerning to your Nirvana. You call it Ekha. Your relationship in the universe is called one of the Sutta in Mahayana. Your first passage is the teaching, implies the teaching through the world. It's on your current condition. So it's similar to the Nidana Vanga, which is from the Sanhika.
Yeah.
But it's not more and
nada. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's more elaborate and nada.
Yeah.
And they share that your first measure of the Buddha teaching.
Well, that's interesting because in the Mahavaga it says that the Buddha reflected on dependent origination just after his Dhamma. And in the Pali commentaries it says that he reflected on the Patana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that it makes sense in Mahavaga.
Similar tradition, yeah.
So we first mentioned in the
Abhidhamma. So the Patana, just for those of you not familiar, the Patana is an Abhidhamma book which deals with dependence and conditionality. So according to the commentarial tradition, the Buddha reflected on that after his enlightenment. And that was when, incidentally, as a piece of Buddhist trivia, they're having their trivia night tonight in Sydney, by the way. That was when the Buddha emanated the rays of the different colours which are now found in the Buddhist flag. So if you've ever wondered where the colours in the flag come from, that's when they come from.
I just
I am, yes, and that's why I just mentioned that. Yeah, position. When the Buddha, according to the commentarial, Pali commentarial explanation, after the Buddha became enlightened, he reflected on the Patthana. Now, the Patthana is the longest and most boring book ever written. And so, according to the Theravadins, it must be the most profound. And so, when he was doing that, he was filled with such joy and rapture that his body emanated rays of different colours. And it gives the colours of them, which are these colours here, blue, yellow, red, white and orange. I don't know, but when they formed that flag, that's what they used for it. I think it was Paula Rahula, if I remember correctly, who designed that flag. Yeah.
But to me, all the compilation of the different tracks, the Pali compilation, they're not needed.
I mean, I think that the Pali school identified itself as that was a very important thing, like the Parisambhita does. It's very important in the Pali. But just to come back to that point, it's very similar to computer, and the other similarity is in terms of backups and redundant information, yeah? And this is one of the laws of computing, is if you don't have at least two copies of data, it doesn't exist, yeah? Law of computing. So this is the law of the suttas as well. You've got to have at least two or three copies of the suttas around everywhere because you don't know what's going to happen. What happens if they drop a bomb on all the monastery where all the Digha reciters are and then the Digha's gone? Well, you've still got all the teachings in the Majjhima and so on. So that's been very, very important as to why the teachings have been passed down so effectively.
I think because of the systematic compilation and it's trustworthy.
The question is, what does the Abhidhamma Pitaka contain? We're a bit after 6 o'clock, so we've been going for 2 hours already, so we may have to be content with a very brief explanation. But the Abhidhamma Pitaka, well, let me be content with a slightly less than brief explanation. Second book here, Vibhanga. What do we find? Khanda Vibhanga, Ayatana Vibhanga, Dhatu Vibhanga, Satcha Vibhanga, Indriya Vibhanga, Patichasamuppada, Saripatthana, Samuppadana. These are all exactly the same topics as in the Samyutta Nikaya. Yeah? And in fact, a lot of them simply start by quoting from suttas that you find in the Samyutta Nikaya. So this is called the analysis according to the suttas. And so this is the first line here in this particular book. These five khandhas form feeling, perception, sankhara, and consciousness. And so what they're doing is this particular book, the Vibhanga, which is probably one of the earlier Abhidhamma books, it's taking these central topics from the suttas, it's giving a basic sutta statement on them, and it's then going on to develop very detailed analysis of that. So that's what the Vibhanga does. Some of the other more developed Abhidhamma books are less closely related to the suttas, and they in fact develop in the Dhammasangani and the Patthana, they've developed extensive lists of dhammas, which are then subject to various kinds of analysis and permutation and so on. So the basic list of dhamma in the Dhammasangani is kusala dhamma, akusala dhamma, abhyakata dhamma, wholesome dhammas, unwholesome dhammas, and undetermined dhammas. So then it begins, well, what's wholesome? and like what's wholesome, which dhammas are wholesome dhammas, which dhammas are unwholesome dhammas, and then combining them and so on in various kinds of ways. So it becomes a very extensive analysis. So that's the primary analytical form of the Pali Abhidhamma. The Katavattu is slightly different. The Katavattu is a set of dialogues about controversial theses. Yeah. So Abhidhamma is best understood as like an academic or scholarly compilation. The origin of basically the Abhidhamma approach. Yeah. Okay, so we should probably finish up there. You've all been very patient. We've been going on for quite some time. So next week. Essentially, this week has been an answer to the question of if we've been talking about Digha Nikaya number 2, and so it's an explanation of what that means. Okay, and. Next week we'll look at the title of the sutta, Samanipala Sutta, and we'll see if we can finish an explanation of the title of the sutta next week. You're beginning now to realise how we're going to be taking 3 months to finish. Okay. Let's finish by paying respects.